Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Thea is off travelling in search of the perfect pineapple-based pizza. Which reminds me, at the weekend I spend most of my time in supermarkets, obviously, and I saw something called, Lucy Dallas, a pulled jackfruit barbecue pizza for vegans. And I, as a no-nonsense northerner, weaned on bread and dripping, as I'm sure you were, I can't believe you have any truck with that.
Of course I was weaned on bread and dripping. I've got a lot of caveats with that whole that sentence.
Okay.
Why do you spend most of your time in supermarkets?
I think it's because I have three children and one of them is a baby who I have to go walk. But they have a really nice life in every other respect, so I feel I've got
so
to penalise
them.
Them.
Go. Okay.
Yeah, we live near to a supermarket as well, so I feel like I'm often going out to get things I've forgotten.
Okay.
And because little baby Phoebe's 15 months old, you just need to leave the house sort of
yes,
every two hours.
I understand that. I understand. I didn't know if it was your leisure activity.
No.
I mean, I'm not judging.
No.
Pulled jackfruit barbecue pizza. I've got no problem with a jackfruit.
Have you? I've never tried it.
Or being pulled. I don't understand. Why would you barbecue a pizza?
No, it's barbecue sauce.
Oh, I see. I thought you were supposed to barbecue the pizza.
I think Thea would literally have some sort of anaphylactic shock.
I might rather have a normal
pizza,
but that's not, can I say, because I was weaned on dripping.
Were you, though?
No.
Have you had bread and dripping in your life? I did.
I have had
I'm from the Midlands and I had it. You must have had it.
Yeah,
What sort of Northerner are you?
It's not a vegan meal.
No. By any stretch of the imagination. Anyway, if you want to get a cheap subscription to the TLS where we don't talk that much about jackfruit or dripping, if you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. It's £5 or dollars for 5 issues. This week marks the anniversary of the beginning of the end of the Cold War, and we've devoted much of the TLS to considering various aspects of all that. On this week's show, Sarah Lonsdale has been reviewing a book about the writers who took up Cold War causes, because they would have been killed if they didn't, because they wanted to, or because they were being manipulated into it without their knowledge. She will tell us more about all that. Jane Yeager has been looking at punk rock in East Germany, which was a key feature in the eventually successful opposition to the government. After all, the very existence of punks meant that not everyone was the same in their appreciation of the communist state. Nothing says resistance like shouty people with bad hair and homemade piercings. Plus, we'll have a love-in about Le Carré with Robert Potts, our managing editor, who can talk us through the work of that Cold War great. The Cold War is traditionally placed in the second half of the 20th century, but as Sarah Lonsdale notes this week, you could start a bit earlier and say that the Cultural War of Ideas had been secretly waged since at least 1919. That was when the Communist International, or Comintern, was created, when the world began to divide into two opposing sides, and when artists and writers began to be co-opted in the struggle. Sarah has reviewed Duncan White's vast Cold Warriors, writers who waged the literary Cold War, calling it a monumental effort at telling the story of how novelists, spy agencies, activists and journalists, collaborators and honest brokers danced a complex interwoven gavotte throughout this fraught age. It's a tale of the weaponization of storytelling in the service of propaganda. Some of it honourable, some of it less so. Sarah's in the studio with us now to tell the tale. Sarah, hello.
Hello there.
Should we start this idea in 1919, the Comintern seems to start the process, or at least the process in this context of art being used for politics. Is that fair, do you think?
Yes. So the Comintern stole a march, really, on Western intelligence agencies in establishing a series of front organisations, theatres, publishers, even travel agencies. So there was InTourist, which organised travels to Moscow for left-leaning writers to try and show them the joys of collectivisation. And they really were about 20, 30 years ahead of the CIA and the British, who were a little amateurish in getting going on that.
I want to talk about the amateurishness, because this has a great anecdote in it, your piece. Somerset Maugham being sent to Moscow, in inverted commas, to stop the communist revolution. Is that really true that they said...
Well, that's what Somerset Maugham said in his memoir. And actually, it does ring true in that being a newspaper foreign correspondent was a classic cover for spies. And of course, in those days, there was no training, really. People would just go down the clubs and talk to their fellow writers and say, listen, old chap, would you like to go to Moscow?
Old chap and, being the operative word, indeed. I would have thought. In this context.
It is amazing how anything got done. We reviewed a book which I'd read about how Britain lured America into the Second World War. And it basically involved asking a well-brought-up chap to go over to America with a bit of money and see what he could do. And there's a kind of amateurishness about the whole... I kind of wonder how anything ever got done. If your idea of covert anti-espionage is to send Somerset Maugham to Moscow to stop a revolution. It doesn't feel very sophisticated, does it?
Well,
it
clearly wasn't successful. hadn't had the right training. But it did produce, of course, a series of wonderful short stories.
Yeah.
The Ashendon series, which I think Ian Fleming probably borrowed a few of Ashendon's characteristics of, including liking to drink dry martinis.
Oh, really?
Oh, I see.
And you make the point in this with a lot of British authors... Maugham being one, but Graham Greene, Ian Fleming, were spies. So do spies make good storytellers, or do storytellers make good spies?
I think it's a mixture of both. They're both engaged in making up stories, in uncovering the secrets of the human heart, and in betraying people's emotions, leading people down the garden path, and in making sense of lots of disparate leads, which have to turn into a honed narrative in the end. So I think there is a lot of similarity in the two professions, and journalism, of course. A lot of journalists were spies as well as novelists.
Yeah. I wonder if it seems to me that particularly the successful storytellers were not necessarily very good spies. They kind of did a year or two, and it was actually very good material for them, but they didn't, as you say, stop the revolution or do anything particularly. They traded on it for a long time.
Yes, absolutely. And I think your classic case there is Graham Greene, who, in my view, is probably the best Cold War novelist from Britain, I would say.
We're going to talk about Le Carre later, but there's an argument about Le Carre as well, who's also a spy.
Yes, so, I mean, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Le Carre's novel, I think probably just in terms of sheer edge-of-your-seat Cold War stuff. I mean, it was like when I read that ending and realised what was going on, it was like I was being ambushed.
Yeah.
By a book, which never happened before. Whereas I think Graham Greene, just in his sheer range of those rather shabby, untrustworthy, shady characters hiding in the emotional shadows, he got so much. I mean, he was only working for SIS for a couple of years, but he got an awful lot out of there. Many, many novels, you can see traces of his work as a spy.
We talk about sort of the amateurishness of this. How much do you think, when people were sent to Moscow or by these front organisations, when it was paid for, when British left-leaning intellectuals were seeing the joys of collectivisation, how much was there a willful blindness to what else was going on? Because it feels like there was a reckoning in the 50s when people finally had to say gulags existed, Stalin was murdering people. Was there a gradual realisation? Was there willful ignorance, do you think?
I think there must have been, particularly by the 1930s. I mean, actually, Malcolm Muggeridge, who was also another SIS man, he went to Moscow in the 30s and actually was excoriating about these left-leaning journalists and novelists who were given these tours of Russia. And they went past stations full of starving peasants begging for orange peel. One of the journalists on his party threw out an orange peel, and it was seized upon by these peasants who had nothing to eat at all. So they must have seen what was going on and must have, as you say, turned a blind eye to some extent.
Because Orwell, when he handed in Animal Farm to T.S. Eliot at Faber, T.S. Eliot refused to publish it on the grounds, this was in now 1940s, and effectively Stalin was an ally, and so he didn't want to rock the boat. And so Animal Farm wasn't published by Faber because Eliot basically said the politics of it are a bit dodgy.
He's on our side at the moment.
He's on our side.
I think in my, as far as I know, I think in France it was even later than that, because there were quite a lot of French intellectuals, weren't there, and writers who were going later than the 30s,
yes,
and who were still saying, no, it's fine, it's all fine. And a lot of that didn't come out till late 50s, early 60s, maybe, that they were being shown the kind of, as you say, the official version of it and saying,
yes,
yep, it's all okay.
Yes, of course. And there was also willful blindness, of course, on the other side. So White is very interesting on Stephen Spender, who was editor of Encounter, and who apparently, when it was all revealed that Encounter was part funded by a CIA front organisation, was horrified and devastated. But White is actually quite interesting and has dug up two examples of where slightly pro-communist articles were spiked by other members of the editorial team. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, really, does Spender really not know where the money's coming from? So I think, you know, that happened on both sides.
How malign was the CIA's influence on a magazine like Encounter? Is there any way of writing that they're investing in a magazine that may have had broad propaganda aims but wasn't necessarily solely propaganda? I mean, how negative a view of Encounter should we have?
I don't think that negative, actually. I mean, in fact, I was reading it for a long time before I actually read about the fact that it was from CIA money, and really enjoyed it and was really impressed by the quality of some of the articles. Now, we know that occasionally some good ideas from the editorial board were passed on to the editors to commission slightly pro-American articles, and ditto slightly pro-Soviet articles were suppressed on a couple of occasions. But generally speaking, it was a very impressive magazine, actually.
It wasn't at all obvious, was it? It wasn't that everybody knew.
Yes.
By any means.
And some of the things it did, so it published some early Solzhenitsyn short stories. Solzhenitsyn was a critic of the Soviet regime, having spent many years in the Gulag, but it was also excellent writing, so you need to ask what the balance was there.
And also there is an argument, I mean, maybe moral equivalence is dangerous, but fronting a cultural magazine for mild propaganda purposes versus a regime that was, and as Solzhenitsyn puts it, you know, destroying the living memory of the nation by effectively, if you disagreed with the regime, you were sent to a gulag or murdered.
Yes.
I mean, is it just very Western biased of me to think, well, in the great scheme of things, CIA supporting Encounter or...
I think in terms of artistic endeavours, you're right. I mean, the CIA didn't just do that, of course.
That's
true. It did a bunch of other stuff. Yeah.
I think they try and assassinate Castro
with an exploding cigar.
Several hundred
times.
Yeah,
with an exploding cigar. I mean, the problem with the CIA stuff, because I've read a lot of CIA novels, and you think, oh my God, they didn't do that, did they? And then when that stuff was all declassified and you saw what they did do, I mean, it really is, they did try and use LSD. They were going to do LSD they were dropping it into Cuba so people thought Jesus was arriving and stuff like that. They did actually do that. And they did it. They did one experiment with LSD where they gave it to some government employee without telling him that he was taking LSD, and he walked out of a window.
And then after a bit they went, maybe we'll go easy on the LSD.
So, I mean, none of this is necessarily purist, is it, at all, I guess. Is it very male? Sarah, is this a world? I think every person we've mentioned thus far,
yes,
is a man.
And that's part of my criticism of White's book. There are a couple of women he mentions. He mentions the American novelist Mary McCarthy, yeah. and he also mentions the Russian poet Anna Akhmatova, and a couple of minor roles from other women. But that's about as far as it goes. I think there were certainly women writers and activists who were working very hard in this area. I mean, I mention Muriel Rukeyser, the American poet, at the beginning of the review, just to try and sort of set the record straight a little bit. I think, as always in these areas, women's memoirs and women's lives are harder to unpick and uncover. And I think a lot of the time, because White is using biographies and published memoirs here, it is harder to find the women's work. You have to work at unravelling it.
And presumably the nature of the culture was they didn't send a female foreign correspondent, they sent Somerset Maugham. So an awful lot of the patriarchal influence would have been happening at the time, not just as we're trying to unpick it.
Yes, certainly. Lots of foreign correspondents were men. They were women. Sheila Grant Duff was a woman correspondent working for The Observer in the 1930s and 40s. And she actually, rather like Arthur Koestler, went to Spain and was doing some spy work on behalf of the Republic. And she was extraordinarily brave, went off to Spain on her own and ended up climbing into the American consul in Malaga's garden to try and get an interview with him, but only not having realised that Franco had just taken Malaga and all the officers that the American consul was entertaining were actually Spanish and not American.
Oh,
so there were women. They were always outsiders, though. I think you can say that.
One of the Mitfords went to Spain.
I was going to say, yeah. Well, she ran away.
It's Decker,
yeah.
And she goes. She ends up in America as a muckraking journalist, but she starts off.
Sent Nancy to try and get her back, and she sort of tricked her and said, oh, just come with us, we're just going to have the... She was on a boat, I think this is right, and they said, oh, we haven't seen you for ages, just come and have tea with us on this lovely boat, we're just going to say hello and then we'll let you go. And they were going to whisk her off.
Yes.
And in fact, she did do a bit of... Jessica did a bit of, not exactly reporting, but she wrote about it later,
yes,
didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Is a whiff of poshness in a lot of this, isn't it? When you read about spying generally of that period, there's a sort of the public school kind of schoolboy features quite heavily. And, you know, it's not that surprising that I think Mitford went with Churchill's nephew, was the person she eloped with. Romilly, I want to say, something like
Romilly.
Yeah. So is there a feeling of this? There's a certain class of people that we're often talking about.
Absolutely.
Here?
I mean, you probably went to Oxford or Cambridge. You probably went to public school, and your parents were probably very well connected. And actually, White makes a very good point about that, particularly about the British spies, in that, you know, they did very good work and worked very, very hard in the 1940s and 50s. They were working to protect an idea of England that they had, which was kind of pre-Second World War view of England that was very different from England of the 1950s.
Yeah, sort of stratified world where they had a place.
Yes. It is a good read, though.
Yeah, and your piece is lovely. And I feel that we could carry on talking about the various stories that come out of it for a long time, but we'll have to leave it there. Sarah Lunsdale, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Expressing your love can look many different ways, and with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Let's have a little pop quiz. Fingers on buzzers. Who recognises this song? Rocking away in the studio here. That was...
I was headbanging a bit there.
You were a little bit. That was impressive.
Thank you.
That was Prügelknaben, or Whipping Boys, by Schleimkeim, or Slime Germ. A rough translation. Top marks, if you got it.
I think I'm prepared to bet that not a single listener of this podcast got that.
I think maybe not, because the reason they wouldn't is because Schleimkeim were a punk band from the 80s living in East Germany, in the DDR. It turns out that novelists and journalists were not the only cultural figures waging the Cold War. There was a DIY movement going on, initiated by Western punk and specifically the Sex Pistols, but which had very serious political and social significance and real danger attached to it. Jane Yeager has written about it for us this week in her review of Burning Down the House, H-A-U-S.
Good joke.
By Tim Moore. Jane, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I said that the punk movement was set off by the Sex Pistols, and specifically it was, in fact, one person who heard them. Can you tell us about that and what happened to her?
Yeah, so it was not easy to hear punk in the DDR, because the radio was heavily censored, all media were heavily censored, but in most parts of the country, you could still get Western radio stations illegally. The first known punk in East Berlin, according to the book, was a 15-year-old girl named Britta, who in the summer of 1977 heard the song Pretty Vacant on a Western radio station. And she also, through friends or relatives in the West, had access to a smuggled West German music magazine and saw pictures of the Sex Pistols. And she felt very inspired and spoken to. And just as one person on her own sort of had a conversion experience and became a punk, which started with putting together a punk look. And this was really DIY on a completely different level than in the West. She just sort of from household goods figured out this look on her own. The impression the book gives is that around the same time, there were probably a few other, you know, teens scattered around the DDR doing the same thing. And then within a few more years, they had found places to gather together. And then after that came bands and then concerts. Yeah.
And did that mean they comprised a threat? I mean, one of the claims in the book that the German government regarded as the number one threat, and the idea of a sort of a 15-year-old girl listening to the Sex Pistols and creating a look with a chain of a toilet plunger.
Classic.
Being, you know, enemy number one. It sounds kind of implausible at one level.
Well, yeah, it does. But, you know, the East German state always took youth culture very seriously as an issue that was sort of existential for their future. And they very aggressively monitored and controlled everything about youth culture because they saw any opposition arising out of it as very dangerous. And punk from very early on came in for a very heavy repression just because it was something that was so visible compared to, you know, other forms of dissonance. It wasn't the first dissident or oppositional movement in the DDR. But one point that the author makes is that if you're an artist or writer or political activist, you could be at a protest one day and you're a threat in that moment. But it is possible for you the next day when you're walking down the street and or at your job to just look like an ordinary citizen. And there's nothing about your appearance or your presence at that time that poses a threat. But because of this sort of very apparent, like, visual aspect of being a punk, it meant that you are visibly in opposition to the normal society. And every moment when you're, like, visible in public, there's no turning it off. And I think that was something that the state immediately, probably, you know, correctly seized upon as threatening to it.
Because my mind, punk, because of how old I am, just seems really naff. But it probably wasn't. I mean, I imagine, was it not naff? Was
no,
it,
I think. It's, this is obviously a much more serious version of what happened everywhere else. But when it first came, people were. I think people in Britain were pretty awful to punks because they just couldn't understand them at all. And as Jane was saying, it says in the book that if that's how you look all the time, then you are a constant. It's a constant screw you. I'll say the polite version to the rest of society, and you're a constant target. But presumably in the DDR, much more so, because they got beaten, didn't they, Jane? And they got arrested and they got jailed and things.
Yes. One of the ways it's a complicated story is that the Stasi and the police in general did not succeed in stamping out the movement because it had this way of being, because of how sort of decentralized it was and the ways it spread. By the time they would crack down on any given band or scene, it would have spread beyond them and there'd be other people starting their own punk scene. So they didn't squelch it, but they very successfully repressed and broke up any individual band or any individual punks that sort of came within their sights. People were arrested, interrogated, sent to prison, expatriated to West Germany in exchange for hard currency. They succeeded in planting informants within a lot of the bands. And even where they didn't succeed in doing that, they had ways of making it appear to the band that there was an informant among them to sort of instill paranoia, to instill distrust. And that led to several bands breaking up too. Oh,
they were worried. Their constant worry was that they wanted to be part of the West or they wanted to reunify Germany. They wanted all the consumerist stuff. But that's not what the punks wanted, was it? Because they were anti-capitalist. They were good Sex Pistols fans. They were anarchists.
Yeah, actually, one of the ways that the government tried to frame them was saying that they were, this was something from the West, it was imported from the West, they were just imitating the West. But that, yeah, you're right, that was not the case at all. They did not look to the West as far as what they, you know, a lot of the music they got was literally smuggled in from the West. But as far as like the society that they wanted to build, they wanted a sort of anarchist socialism. They wanted a better East Germany. They wanted to build something new, sort of from scratch. They did not want to, they did not look fondly to capitalism.
Lucy, can we hear another song? I want to hear some more.
Yes, because you love DDR punk from the 80s. Well, the one
I love Schleimkeim.
We can hear a bit more Schleimkeim, because I was going to say the first one we heard was fairly recognisable as punk, but there were other things, ska things that came in, and also interesting, thoughtful lyrics. And there's this one called Geldschein, which is about money, which again is the anti-capitalist thing,
yeah.
Which is a bit like ska, but it's also got a sort of umpa thing, which is like German folk music, which is traditionally very conservative.
We're going to have to hear a
bit of... Yeah, let's hear a bit of Geldschein.
Geldschein, geh von Hand zu Hand, wechsel ständig den Besitzer und nicht das aufgedruckte Land. Ich war schon in Hongkong und das schon in Wien, selbst in einem Inderjob in Ost-Berlin.
I don't like that as much.
In Ost-Berlin. It's interesting though, isn't it? Because it does sound like ska, and do you see what I mean about the bass line?
The umpa, umpa. What do you think, Jane? Would you like that?
Yeah, I couldn't really... make out the lyrics that much, but yeah, it is a bit oompa oompa in the sound.
Yeah,
and it's actually, I think the lyrics are about how the movement of money
and it's quite a sophisticated anti-capitalist sentiment, I would have thought. Jane, can you tell us about the rather unlikely allies that the punks found that I think over we would never guess?
Yeah, I found this part of the story so interesting. The church, the Lutheran church, was a really important part of this story because the punks would never have gotten to play any concerts in the DDR if it weren't for the church offering them, first of all, a space to hang out once they got banned from meeting in public spaces, which the church was able to do because it had certain freedoms that no other organization had, and this is how it became sort of a center of dissident movements in general. But then they also hosted the first punk concerts, and the sounds like quite an unlikely alliance. And in the history of the DDR, especially at this time, you do often find the church at the center of, or at least involved in a lot of things that have to do with the opposition. And I guess in that sense, it's not surprising. But what I found surprising is that there seemed to be a sense in this history of a deeper and genuine affinity between these dissident ministers whose churches hosted the punks and put on these first concerts and the East German punk movement, where they really saw themselves as having a lot of things, though certainly not everything, in common.
Well, maybe Jesus was the original punk. Discuss.
There's an interpretation you can put on that. They're ministering to their community.
Well, Jane, it's filled with great stories. And I'd like to think that we've introduced a bit of music to people that they've not previously heard. Although, if anyone has heard that, do let us know. If people are saying, of course, Schleimkeim.
Of course it was. They were playing Prügelknabe, and of course it was that.
Of course they were.
You know, I don't think I had heard those particular songs before, but while I was working on the piece, I did look around on YouTube, and there are quite a few songs and even, you know, videos of the... of East German punk bands from the 80s, if one is interested in finding them.
And I hope people will now be interested. Jane Yeager, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
So I associate childhood reading with black coffee and spy books, the former which I expended some time and energy in making myself like, because characters in the latter seem mostly to live off it. I still regularly consume both, of course, and the books of John le Carré have lingered long in my imagination. Picking them up, as Mick Herron mentions in the tier list this week, often re-triggers the emotions they provoked the first time, emotions allied to the feelings of being young. Herron, himself a very fine writer of spy books, has written a lovely essay on his relationship with le Carré, who is surely in the conversation for being one of Britain's greatest living novelists. Question. Le Carré's latest novel, Agent Running in the Field, A Tale of Russia and Brexit Britain, is also reviewed in this week's TLS by Ian Thompson, who says that the author has lost little of his gift for creating Big Brother atmospherics and pages of taut dialogue. So we thought we'd consider the career of le Carré with Robert Potts, who is a le Carré fan of good standing. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
So I sort of blithely talked about the greatness of le Carré. And has he broken out of the ghetto of being just a spy genre writer? Do you think he is a sort of recognisably big, major figure?
I don't think he's broken out of the ghetto of spy writing because all of his novels, bar one, are spy novels. But I do think he's a great writer in the way that Stephen King in horror is great.
Yeah.
Or James Ellroy as a thriller, because they have a style that's very, very distinctive and incredibly effective, as much so as any literary writer.
Yeah.
I quite agree. I don't think you need... There isn't a ghetto. He's just a great writer and he happens to write about spy things.
So I wonder whether... when we've done things in the paper, though, novelists you're most excited about, we did that, the new Elizabethans thing. I'm just wondering whether people wouldn't necessarily say le Carré, even though they might think of him as the writer they were most looking forward to reading. I'm just struck by the fact that he is a major literary figure still writing, and he's often not described as that. He's just like, here's another spy thriller by le Carré.
I wonder about that. I wonder if it's got to the position where he's of sufficient grandeur for him not to be involved in those discussions.
Yeah,
it's normally about up-and-coming people, because le Carré's A Spy Came In From the Cold, that was a bestseller, and that really made his reputation back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And ever since, it's been, oh, there's a new le Carré, you get excited.
And you better go get it.
Yeah.
Is it atmospherics, or is it good at the level of the sentence?
It's definitely good at the level of the sentence. I've been looking over them again, and what he does is... the descriptions, they're very, very taut. They're quite witty. Sometimes they're quite catty. And they're analytic, and they are like little reports that some agent might file of their target. This is how they dress, this is their weakness. And they're very, very deftly done. And the other thing he does is he rolls between a kind of omniscient third-person narration, and then he lets the thoughts and feelings of whichever character is at the forefront of that point seep into that style. And yeah, it's very, very nicely done.
That's what Hilary Mantel does, and she's a literary writer.
Exactly. If it wasn't for the spying...
Indeed.
It's also, from what I remember, it's very spare. There's nothing flabby there, is
That's
there?
Exactly right. It's very, very lean, economical, laconic.
I found The Honourable Schoolboy is weirdly long, because they tend not to be that long, his Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, I reread recently. And there is a very tautness to it, isn't it? It's not over long. It's not, you get a feeling that some spy novels, we might talk about other spy novels later, they're sort of bulked out a bit. They tend to be these big, baggy monsters. You know, here's a doorstopper of a spy novel. He didn't seem to write them that often.
They're not long, but they are not fast either. So in that sort of brevity, it's a perfectly decent sort of novel-length book, but very little happens, in a sense. That's the difference between this and a lot of thriller or spy genre books, is a lot of it's very, very slow. It's a build-up, it's a stakeout, it's research, it's teasing out the contradictions in somebody's story. Everything is done at the level of dialogue or a flicker of a facial expression and so on. People are looking very, very closely. There's often a duel going on, and then somebody gives something away, and that leads to everything else falling out. And then near the end, there can be a moment of brief but shocking violence. It does erupt, but it's not in the foreground ever, the violence.
And there's a kind of shabbiness, isn't there? There's a kind of... The whiff of... Mick Herron talks about this, and when I think of Le Carré, I kind of think of rain-spattered streets and sort of slightly shabby, unclean cups of tea and coffee and a sort of Britishness that is... It lingers, but it's not proud and impressive, is it? There's a certain smallness to it.
Definitely. There's no glamour. It's not like the Bond novels. There's no cocktails and smart clothes. It is shabby. It does those films, those TV programmes where they do it in complete sort of grey, black and white, 1970s, dirty counters and unsatisfactory meals. It's all there. It's that side of seedy, rundown Englishness.
But it's odd. It's that thing, because Mick Herron says that... he was quoting someone that when you're reading Le Carré, you're hearing the last beat of the secret English heart. And it's like what you were saying, they're defending something. And then you think, oh, look at what they're defending. Kind of horrible formica and cups of tea, but it's a sense of the right thing, goddammit. Yeah.
I think this is absolutely crucial with Le Carré. This is where he reminds me of Rudyard Kipling, because he has a sense of Englishness as an ethos, as something of value, but beyond its institutions, and in fact counter to the institutions. Yeah. So mostly people are working against any of the organisations and institutions that ostensibly make up England or the state, but they're after something much more valuable.
Yeah.
There's a bit at the end of Tinker Tailor where Peter Gwillem has discovered that Bill Hayden is the mole. Sorry about the spoilers.
What?
And
it's been out long enough. I think people are going to have to wear that.
And he becomes very, very angry and upset. And Le Carré writes, Hayden was more than his model. He was his inspiration, the torchbearer of a certain kind of antiquated romanticism, a notion of English calling, which, for the very reason that it was vague and understated and elusive, had made sense of his life until now. In that moment, Gwillem felt not merely betrayed, but orphaned.
Yeah.
So that's what they're fighting.
You get that actually in John Buchan novels, which are thrillers, but again, there's this sort of hankering after a value system of England in the Richard Hannay books, with a kind of a decency, a kind of yeomanry that must stand for something if anything is going to stand for something.
But it's not what you see in the novels, because what you see, especially in the institutions, is actually double-dealing.
Mm. How different are they, is the circus from what's going on in the KGB? They're broadly the same patterns of people, aren't they?
That was the beauty of the Cold War novels, and he did that very deliberately, that sort of ambivalence about the methods and the means and the ends and what people valued and what people could be bought off for and so on. And he did do it very deliberately. First of all, he said that with the spy came in from the cold, where the whole thing involves such layers of duplicity and betrayal, very, very startlingly so. And Le Carré said afterwards that the Americans seemed to get the point of this much more than the British did, which is why he followed it up with Looking Glass War, where a group of spies, not the circus, but a sort of outmoded, failing institution still left over, still think they've got one big play to make, and they are all shabby incompetent on the way out, and they all get mopped up at the end, and somebody loses that big time because they've forgotten the basics of their tradecraft that they've been taught all the way through the book, because they've fallen in love with a girl or whatever, and the whole thing falls apart, and he said, this is satire. That was the point, to show that it isn't a glamorous world. It's just full of ordinary people who completely screw it up.
Can you remember, because Mick Harrier, I said to mention that I remember being a child and reading the Carrier and drinking this sort of black coffee and being sort of very attracted to this sort of feeling. And when I think of Le Carrier, I had this sort of Proustian moment. You can sort of, I can taste the black coffee and I can sort of see the rain against the window. Do you have the same associations, Robert, when you look back at your first time with Le Carrier?
I started reading John le Carré properly in the early 1990s because of the poetry and criticism of Tom Paulin.
Of course.
Yes, yeah. And Tom Paulin wrote this beautiful poem called Waftage, an Irregular Ode, which does contain the lines, it was quiet in the circus, Bill Hayden wafted down a corridor. But the main thing is Tom Paulin's having this relationship with this girl and it ends very, very badly. And he's lazing around. He's very, very idle at this point. His girlfriend is painting. So he goes, most every day she'd paint in the loft above the stables while I wandered right through Le Carré. Murder of Quality was where I started. And then a bit later, he talks about James Fenton in Saigon. He says, I thought about how James Fenton read Shakespeare in Saigon, got the complete works in dime paperbacks on the black market. And at that point, I conceived to myself, because you always found John le Carré in a second-hand bookshop, I thought, I'm going to get the lot, but only if I can get them for 30 pence or less in a second-hand bookstore. And over the years, I managed to get the lot, until I caught up with him. And then after that, my shabby paperbacks, which are falling apart from second-handness and love, become shiny hardbacks that I was given for birthdays and Christmas. Yeah. So,
or you've stolen from the TLS book table.
I couldn't possibly say either way. So I did steal one
That's
from a pub once,
true.
Actually. Where they had you know, one of the pubs that has books all over the shelves, which are there for ornament rather than use.
Quite right, you've got to take them.
I need Single and Single, I'm having that.
Yeah, so, quite right.
My Jean Genet moment. So that is how I got into Le Carré. And all I do remember is that over those years, there were two things. There was the thrill of the chase in the secondhand bookshops. But whenever I was reading them, I was never happier than I was reading John Le Carré. For 3 days or so, I would just be... I didn't want to do anything else, and I was lost.
There aren't that many authors like that. I mean, that's a great joy in life, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Is he a man of the 70s, Bob, in your mind? You know, it's very much your period,
the 1970s. So I was a child then.
Yeah. But do you associate... I mean, is he someone who reached his peak then because that was the height of the Cold War and he was writing into the context of his own times, and then since then he's still written very well, but he's not been quite of his time in the same way?
I think... there are two things there. I think he never does anything that is better than Tinker Tailor and Smiler's People. Those two books of the trilogy are outstanding. And I think it is true that the further he gets away from his own practice as an agent from the sort of 50s and 60s, the more researched it becomes and the less there is for him to grapple with. And so a lot of the post-1989 stuff after the end of the Cold War... you can see that a lot of it is straight out of the newspapers and various scandals and so on. I mean, not that it's not well done. So the Constant Gardener, that was a true pharmaceutical scandal, and he brings it out beautifully. And then in the... what's the one about the translator, the Mission Song? There's that whole Equatorial Guinea coup that we remember so fondly. And... so he does it really, really well, but you don't feel it's got the same investment, and it doesn't have the same moral landscape, the complexity, the balanced complexity. What you've got thereafter are real crooks, whether they're the arms dealers or the people in the British establishment who are supporting them, or the pharmaceutical companies, whatever it is, or the Americans ever since the War on Terror. He's really gone quite hard in that direction. And they are obviously villains, and so the poor, tragic figures who get caught up and very near the end, perhaps over a love affair or just incompetence, they just screw up that last detail and they always get blown by the end. They're the good guys.
Can I just nip in about that when you said before, it's because they've fallen in love, or they make a slip, or because it's a love affair, or, you know. And Mick Herron makes the point that this also is a very male world. I mean, he's describing a very male world. There's not many female characters with much agency, are there?
No, and he doesn't draw them well. I think that's very fair to say.
I can't think of. There's the little drummer girl, isn't there?
Yeah.
Charlie. It was very, very nicely done.
And there's who's Connie Sachs.
Connie Sachs.
Yeah, she's the sort of...
She's very smart, isn't she?
Yeah, but you get to her, and she is, she's brilliant, but by the stage you get to her, she's very, very drunk and dying, I think, by the last novel.
Yeah.
And she's having a relationship with a young woman who had a nervous breakdown when Smiley was in charge of the circus. And
yeah.
It's all very kind of... It's shambles, isn't it? They've got animals everywhere and,
yeah,
and she's always
it's
on
It's an
the
old boys' club he's writing about, really, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
I mean, but that is reality,
well,
I suspect,
was.
As well.
Is it still? I don't know. I mean,
I don't know.
I'm just
and
asking.
the worlds he describes, they are the clubs of London and yeah. Piccadilly and St James or whatever. And then there's, you know, when he's doing the Russian oligarchs, they all gather together and the women are there entirely as prostitutes.
Yeah.
And it's unremittingly that.
Okay, I want to end by favourite John le Carré and then any favourite spy fiction. I love spy fiction. I've got three. Spy fiction, but gone. I don't know le Carré as well as you, Robert. Give me your. If you could only read one le Carré, is it Tinker Tailor?
Yes, with Smiley's people a very close second. Yeah. But yes, it definitely is.
Lucy,
I'm pretty unversed in it. I'm afraid.
Have you read Tinker
Tailor? No, I think I've read The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, yeah. And I've seen Tinker Tailor, which I've seen the film.
Not the Alec Guinness.
No, but I've seen the.
And that was one of the great. Robert, that was one of the great TV portrayals, arguably ever, wasn't it? That people see Smiley as
it's
Guinness.
Hard not to. I mean, it really is. It was very effectively done, and that's the pitch that will always come into your mind.
And any spy fiction that you tell what I'm reading at the minute?
Go on.
Well, among other things, Len Deighton.
I'm very, reading, very good classical French chef.
I know he was, and he wrote a cookbook.
Yeah.
But I'm reading Game. He did, yeah. Game, Set and Match, have you ever read these?
I never did Len Deighton. A lot of boys at my school
they're
did.
They're really good.
Did he do SSGB?
He did SSGB. And actually, if you read the prose, there's a little bit of hard-boiled in them, but they're beautifully written, beautifully written. And Game, Set and Match is set in... We're in the 80s, Cold War isn't down, the wall isn't down yet, and it's another shabby, marital breakdown... failed, growing fat spy trying to work out his way through this ambivalent world. It's very le Carré, actually. Maybe slightly less high-end, but it's still really good. I think you'd like it.
Because now that you asked the question, I realise I don't really read spy fiction apart from le Carré. He's the exception. The exception I would make to that is I do remember enjoying Our Man in Havana by Graham Greene.
Yeah, well, we talked about Graham Greene.
Le Carré could almost does a homage to with The Tailor of Panama.
Yeah.
It's his...
Well, the ones I've read more than once, Norman Mailer's great spy novel Harlot's Ghost, which is, I think, 1,400 pages long, and it's a tale of the CIA. So it's great. And another tale of CIA is a book called The Company, which Mick Herron mentions actually in his book because it's by Robert Little. And he talks about the phrase walking back the cat. And the role of spies is to walk back the cat, which is to try and find the source of the leak, to find who out the mole is.
Are you walking back the cat to its bag? Because someone has let the cat out of the bag.
I think you're walking back a cat which has wandered all over the place. So it is an incredibly torturous... Trying to walk back a cat... I think it's herding cats.
Somebody let it
out of the bag.
I thought I got the idea. I thought it was more like herding, reverse herding
reverse
cats.
Reverse herding cats.
But if you... The Company, another giant novel. It's really good. It's really good. And interestingly, it has the idea of the barium meal, which is where you give radioactive information to a series of sources and then you find out who reports it onwards.
Waggis of Christie.
Exactly, which is the method Colleen Rooney did to identify Rebecca Vardy. And some listeners who hear that will have no idea what I'm talking about, so I'll just say to you, Google Colleen Rooney, Rebecca Vardy.
Surely no one can escape that piece of information.
Robert Potts, what a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Robert Potts, to Jane Yeager and to Sarah Lonsdale. Lucy, are you back for one more week?
I am, if you'll have
Thea's
me.
Return. Yep. Hurrah! Do get subscribing to the tier list and get hold of this week's issue. All you might ever need to know about the Cold War, plus an awful lot more stuff, including the fat and great Australian poet Les Murray. Next week, the TLS launches a new website and redesign, and the first from our brilliant new imprint, TLS Books. It's exciting. We'll begin with a book of essays by TLS writer, among other things, Virginia Woolf. And it's the anniversary of George Eliot's birth as well, so we'll talk about that great writer too. Do not miss it. Till then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.